Welcome to The Reason Roundtable, your weekly podcast that swears it'll stop talking about the Webathon sometime real soon, just not in this episode of the podcast. I am Matt Welsh, joined by Nick Gillespie, Peter Suderman, and Catherine Mankiw Ward. Hi, everyone.
Howdy.
Hey, Matt.
Happy Monday.
One of the many comments that we got about the Webathon is that someone was really, really happy the way that Catherine says howdy, which is really weird.
I'm so full of joy to be with you. It's a Hanukkah howdy today.
That's the final
day of Hanukkah. It's upon us.
Light it up. As Robert Plant taught us, in the light, everyone sees the light. Okay, we're going to talk here in a moment about not Robert Plant or Hanukkah necessarily, although it's all related, but we're going to talk about abortion in the Supreme Court. That's a nice segue. But even before all of that, do you find yourself defeated even before you start trying to keep up with the news? Thwarted by paywalls, distracted by clickbait, trapped in a rabbit hole of doom? Well, imagine an app where you can get unlocked access to the most reliable news sites. An app that filters out fake news and trashy listicles. They still have those? BuzzFeed? While showing stories from multiple perspectives in order to counter bias. Where you can find good news and little treasured bits of information unearthed from around the globe. All of this and more is available from an innovative Australian startup called Inkle, I-N-K-L. Inkle.com has signed partnerships with more than 100 news sources, such as The Economist, The Atlantic, Bloomberg, creating a unique system combining journalists and algorithms to create a best of news feed. You can get more than $12,000 of premium news content for just $100 a year. If you go right now to inkle.com/podcast, they'll make a little sparkly noise and give you an additional 25% discount. So that's a whole year's worth of headache-free news for just $75. Go to inkl.com/podcast today. You'll be glad you did. All right. The Supreme Court last week heard oral arguments in Dobbs versus Jackson Women's Health, a case about the legality of a Mississippi law banning abortion after 15 weeks of gestation. Upholding the ban would almost certainly require overturning the landmark and landmarkly controversial, that's fine, 1973 case Roe versus Wade, which prohibited abortion bans prior to a fetus's ability to survive outside the womb. Questioning by the Republican-appointed judges on the court indicated at least a preliminary interest in revisiting or overturning Roe, particularly the very hard to pin down exactly viability standard, which generally rests somewhere in the 20 to 24 weeks range into a pregnancy. I would, before we talk about it, direct all listeners to heavily consume not just the substance of your choice, but the writing on this case in particular at our site by Damon Root and Jacob Sullum, and of course by the whole crew over at the Volokh Conspiracy. I think the last time I checked, Josh Blackman had 40 posts on the Dobbs case. He even sort of collated them all. You will get the legal analysis you crave there. Here we're going to talk more about how this all might play out in like the real world, man. Catherine, you're the editor of Reason. This case will have a profound influence on American politics, on Nick's ability to exhale theatrically into microphones, on the direction of the conservative and libertarian legal movements, and of course on pregnant women and their fetuses. But I was struck, and of course I'm surprising you with this, I was struck by a factlet that I read in an old Jacob Sullum piece, which goes as follows. Only 95% of abortions happen before the 15-week mark. Only 95% as many. You know what I mean? Like only 5% after. Yes, 95% before 15 weeks and 5% afterwards. When you stretch that out to 21 weeks, only 1% happen after 21 weeks. So could it be that we're losing our minds politically over something that is statistically not huge? Or is that a monstrous anti-individualistic way of looking about a life and death issue?
So I will start by saying that this weekend we had a social gathering at Peter Suderman's house where cocktails were consumed. And one of the highlights of that party was a bunch of Reason staffers, a couple drinks in, standing around fighting about abortion. So I just want to say, and I say that actually sincerely, like it was genuinely a good time. But I just want to say that there is a pretty substantial disagreement among the Reason staff, not just about kind of the underlying moral case about abortion, but also what to do about it legally. I am radically pro-choice. I am radically pro-choice because I think government is bad at everything. I almost think it doesn't matter what the underlying moral status of the fetus is with respect to the mother, although, in fact, I also believe that it is not incumbent upon the mother to support the fetus morally. But to me, the most important thing is, will government screw this up in a way that harms people? Yes, the answer is yes. And this fight is highlighting that. You are correct, and Jacob Solomon is correct, of course, that we are doing all of this fighting about a relatively small number of edge cases. Now, this could be a hard cases make bad law situation. I'm not sure that's true. I think this is an edge cases test moral intuition situation. And the goal of pro-lifers broadly is simply to reduce the number of abortions that happen in the world, which they consider to be murder. And, you know, I think that there are actually lots of bad things, which include even death, that we should not make a law that just bans them, because that won't always make them go away. Or if it does make them go away, we'll have incredibly high costs in other areas. So that's how I think about this abortion question. And I think the fact that we are fighting about a relatively small number of abortions doesn't mean we shouldn't have the fight, or that the fight is somehow mistargeted, though we often do have fights about a small number of deaths. For instance, fights about vaping regulations, say, where we are missing the point.
Nick, you...
You go
right ahead, doctor.
Yeah. One of the things, though, about this is that this is not the line that is going to be drawn by anti-abortion advocates. They have made it absolutely clear that they believe abortion is murder and that all abortion should be banned. Sometimes they'll say, okay, there's an exception to save the life of the mother. Sometimes, but increasingly rarely, we'll say rape or incest is would be allowed. So to talk about 15 weeks and then say, well, not many happen after that, is missing the point that this is an attempt to illegalize all abortions. And that needs to be taken into, any consideration of the politics of this. I think it's good to point out that most abortions, because one of the questions that lurks around this is that basically, since Roe versus Wade, public opinion on abortion has not changed very much. It's still, most people believe that it should be legal either under all circumstances or under some circumstances. And that has generally meant most people are comfortable with abortion being legal until sometime past, a little bit past viability. And Matt, as you talked about, that's in the low 20-week range. So this is a huge deal. And I think, I say this as somebody who's pro-choice. I think this is a question of bodily autonomy by the woman. I don't think that the fetus has legal status as an individual or as a person at 15 weeks or at viability necessarily. I think I would push it a little bit back. And one of the ideas behind the conservative attacks on abortion is that if only the Supreme Court hadn't issued Roe v. Wade and then later decisions like Casey that build on that, this would have been left to the states and it wouldn't be a hot issue because it would have been worked through the legislative process. Absolutely wrong, because the politics of abortion, or rather the feeling of abortion, hasn't changed. The politics have remained incredibly constant because there is a side that wants to ban all of them. And that's the biggest issue. And the last thing I'll point out, Gallup has been doing polls on this since the early 70s, or actually even before that. One of the things that's fascinating to me is that 24% of voters say that a politician must share their views on abortion for them to vote for them. 19% of those people, of that 24%, are pro-choice, of that 24%, 19% of pro-choice voters say that, 30% of pro-life voters say that.
Peter, there's preemptively and understandably, from their point of view, a lot of very intense upset about this among Democrats and progressives, going after the legitimacy of the court, talking about any number of things. And yet, even in this moment of potential triumph among the anti-abortion, you know, legal movement, if that is a thing to describe, this also might be a dividing line for the conservative legal movement itself, which you have pointed out by pointing to some articles. You want to talk about that a little bit?
Yeah. So Josh Blackman's been writing about this at the Volokh Conspiracy. There is a good piece in the City Journal. It's a long piece that sort of traces the history of the conservative legal movement by J. Joel Alcia, a Columbus School of Law law professor. And what all this sort of boils down to is that the conservative legal movement and the people who consider themselves part of it view Dobbs as in some sense a referendum on that movement's success or failure over the last 50 years, in part because that movement was born out of Roe and out of the view that Roe was bad constitutional law. And I think, you know, one thing that we haven't talked about here is the actual legal underpinning of abortion in the United States, which goes back to Roe. There really isn't a very good constitutional argument for Roe. Roe was not an attempt to just didn't have a whole lot of constitutional stuff in it, right? Like the constitutional aspect, right? Like it wasn't very
constitution-y.
Yeah, right. Like this is I'm trying to be sort of silly here, but like it was an argument that basically said, well, if you squint and sort of try to derive some second order stuff from the Constitution that isn't actually in it, then you can imagine that the Constitution justifies this. But it didn't actually say, hey, here's the words in the Constitution and the principles in the Constitution, and here are the words as they were understood at the time, and here's how the framers understood the Constitution, and here's how we understand the Constitution. There was no attempt to do that in Roe. And notably, when this case was argued at the Supreme Court this last week, there was very little attempt to justify abortion rights on a clear constitutional basis there. Instead, the argument was stare decisis, which is to say, this is a ruling that has been in place, and it would be a radical shift to get rid of it. And so I think you can make the argument that abortion rights are good, you can be pro-choice, and also think that Roe is a bad ruling, and that there's a lot of problems with basing an incredibly controversial, incredibly sort of important to politics part of our legal system on a ruling that I just think that if you are a textualist, an originalist, someone who thinks that the Constitution matters, it's very hard to look at Roe and think that's a great ruling that just like makes a lot of clear sense, and we should be and like clearly adheres to the words in the Constitution. I just think it doesn't.
That, by the way, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, you know, made that critique of Roe, who was an absolute, you know, super pro-choice advocate.
Right.
And we'll point...
That is an argument that people on the left who are pro-choice will make. So I don't feel like that's just a conservative argument that is made, right, that is being made entirely instrumentally.
Having
though there are perhaps
that,
people who are making that instrumentally as well.
Having said that, Damon Root, a couple of days ago at Reason.com, in a piece that is titled The Laissez-Faire Origins of the Supreme Court's Abortion Precedents, he talks about how the early rulings, the ones that predated Roe, such as Griswold v. Connecticut, which had to do with married women having access to contraception, he points out that a lot of this, the legal reasoning is actually tied to the Lochner decisions, which, just to make this all more complicated, was a series of rulings that was identified with laissez-faire economic policy gone amok, has largely been deactivated. But I think from a libertarian point of view, these issues are much more complicated. And in a way, if we are going to say, well, you know, Roe versus Wade was poorly decided and it kind of hints at various things, you know, there's also a kind of substantive due process issue here, which is do women have the right to control their bodies? And I think, you know, that isn't something, regardless of how it gets decided, that's really kind of the issue that needs to be front and center in this. And I think that there are good libertarian reasons, and I recognize that a lot of libertarians disagree with me about this, but to, you know, say that this is ultimately a rights issue that is not, it shouldn't be decided at the level of the, you know, the Supreme Court or over, you know, kind of bad lawmaking in a way, any more than free speech should be, you know, subject to crappy precedents. Let's get rid of free speech.
Catherine.
I also think there's something really delightful, not in the kind of gotcha hypocrisy way, but in a way that sort of probes people's moral intuitions here, that we are having, that this case has ended up landing right in the middle of a moment when, broadly speaking, the American right has rediscovered an interest in bodily autonomy as a core concept for freedom. And, you know, this is obviously with respect to vaccines and masking. But, you know, I think most of the discourse around this has been stupid, right? It's just been like, oh, you like freedom for your uterus, but not for your arm or whatever. It's like, shut up. That's stupid. But in fact, we do have, I mean, humans do have, and I think Americans in particular do have a feeling of, you know, where the scope of the state ends and, you know, the idea that it's at your front door, at the, you know, at the edges of your skin, you know, in your community, like that is a very kind of...
Are you going to stick this landing, Catherine, and mention nether regions or what?
I was going to just go with skin. Skin was going to be the most specific body part I was going to mention here. But I actually think like that probably is the right conversation to be having. And it's a shame that we're only having the dumb version of it. Because as Nick says, a lot of this rests on the question of just like, where does the state have a say? And, you know, my answer is literally nowhere, GTFO, but I recognize that your mileage may vary.
I would like to make a prediction that I've just invented. So it's obviously going to happen. And if it is true, then someone's got to just mail me a check for $100,000. That's an interesting number, Catherine, which we'll get to in a minute. But it is this. So Chief Justice John Roberts famously tries to keep the court out of like disputed, messy American culture war politics. He's motivated by that. And that twists him into pretzels as it did on the Obamacare cases and plenty of others besides. So given that, and also given the, and please go read that Damon Root Lochner piece, which is fascinating. Lochner, broadly speaking, talked about economic rights. And then during the New Deal, people like, screw it. We're going to like shut down the economic rights part of the 14th Amendment and then talk about it more like in due process and individual rights elsewhere. But these ruled previous cases, Griswold especially, but this was also argued in the Dobbs case, they kind of depend on that Lochner view, which is otherwise very unpopular on the left and very popular on especially the libertarian right. So my prediction is John Roberts writes a majority decision upholding Roe by expanding Lochner to include economic rights. I think in your heart, you know I'm right.
Why would you say something so incredibly appealing only for it definitely not to happen? like this is all I want. And
it would be kind of awesome.
Like, here, Catherine, look, it's a cookie. You want this cookie? No cookie.
That happened in Obamacare, right? Like there's he smuggled in a trimming back of the Commerce Clause jurisprudence while doing something that made conservatives otherwise upset. So I think that's what's going to happen. I'm going to transition. Catherine already did it. So I'm just going to follow up on it, which is my body, my choice / transition, # Bill de Blasio. Nick gets
that didn't sound very constitution-y.
The lame duck mayor of New York City, Nick Gillespie's New York City,
lame.
Announced this morning on MSNBC that's all.
It's amazing he got up this early, Matt. This is like the first time he's been up before, like, you know, 10:30, his whole two terms of mayor.
That's the most appealing thing about him.
Yeah. Yeah, he sleeps in.
He announced that all private sector workers as of December 27th of this year will be subject to a vaccine mandate covering some 184,000 businesses. In addition, kids aged 5 and up will have to show proof not just of a first, but a second jab to basically do anything indoors and fun, which is super great because it's really fun to be outdoors in New York City in January and February, what I've always found pretty incredible. Here's a quote from lowercase d, B. We've got Omicron as a new factor. We've got the colder weather, which is going to really create additional challenges with the Delta variant. We've got holiday gatherings. We in New York City have decided to use a preemptive strike to really do something bold to stop the further growth of COVID and the dangers it's causing to all of us, unquote. Catherine, I'm actually going to read to you another quote because it got me in that mood that I get sometimes. And also because you like language. Here it is. Our youngest kids, we got to reach them now. Right now in the city, it's about 20% have gotten to that stage in that 5 to 11 range. I don't really know what he's talking about there, but stay with me. The vaccine is relatively new, but what we're trying to say to parents is it's urgent before Omicron grows, before Delta continues to stress us even worse in the winter months. Get your kid vaccinated. And here's an incentive to do it. Catherine, can you want to talk about the word incentive?
Don't think it means what you think it means, Matt. I mean, it's like there's a reason we say carrots and sticks. Like, this is a stick. There are no carrots here. It's all stick.
But it's always this is presented as carrots. I mean, like all throughout the GD pandemic, it's like, you know, just keep the masks on the 2-year-olds for the next 5,000 years. And that's the way we get to keep schools open. So that's an incentive, right, Catherine?
Right. Again, like in the same way that is an incentive to be like, if you do this, I won't hit you. Like, yeah, I guess in that sense, it's an incentive. But that's not what that word means. That's not what we mean when we say that.
Why do you think I turn in my magazine column?
Yeah. The threat of violence. No. And I think, you know, there is this idea that somehow, you know, I think the thing that's hidden in these comments is because everyone in New York City knows that this is not an enforceable mandate, that for the, you know, by and large, this will be honored more in the breach than in the observance. And so he is presenting it as if it's sort of discretionary, as if he's offering this to you because they don't have the enforcement resources to really come after people. Now, of course, one place that they do have enforcement resources is in schools. And we've already seen this in Los Angeles. They have a mechanism already in place to check for childhood vaccinations, and that will be one of the more enforceable mandates. As always, deeply infuriating since it means that the people least at risk from COVID and its variants, as far as we know, young children, will have the most rigorous enforcement and mitigation measures visited upon them and enforced. I will be able to go into a bar and wave my phone vaguely in the direction of the bartender in New York City, and he'll be like, sure, that looks like maybe it's a vaccination card or whatever, and go about my business. And meanwhile, school children will be masked and have a vax mandate and will apparently be stuck in that hell for all of eternity. This is backwards. This is not the way. In general, at this point, I believe that vaccines are widely available, mandates are ill-advised, that parents who are not getting their children vaccinated or adults who have not gotten themselves vaccinated are not doing so because somehow they were waiting for Bill de Blasio to give them this incentive. They were doing it for reasons of their own, and that this is a question for, you know, for persuasion and not for mandates.
Peter, what part of we got vaccines, we got therapeutics, do people not understand? Serious.
Well, I don't know. What part of it do you not understand? You seem you're a person.
What I don't understand is why we lose our marbles over anything in an atmosphere in which there are therapeutics and there are vaccines. Why are we twisting the nut in all senses of that word ever tighter in a place where, like, we're no longer flying blind without medical help? Thank you. Nick.
So look, if you want to make an argument for requiring people to get vaccines, which I do not, which I do not agree with de Blasio's mandate, but there is a kind of thinking here that says that the two things are happening. One is we've got the Omicron variant that people are scared of because it does appear to be much more transmissible. However, there's some nascent evidence that suggests that it is defeated pretty soundly by a booster shot. And so if you get people up to two shots, which this does, then you get them closer to a booster shot, and this helps that way. And then there's the other, then there's a sort of pre-Omicron argument that Omicron bolsters, which is that it's not enough to let people protect themselves. We have to protect the group by getting everyone vaccinated, because what that does is it reduces transmission down to a level where the vaccine isn't going to have a pool of unvaccinated hosts in which to mutate, in which to create another Omicron. And that's it is true to some extent, right? It is true that to some extent, the more people you have vaccinated, the less space the virus will have to mutate and to come up with sort of new novel ways to defeat the vaccine and existing protections that we may or may not have. However, there is a balance here with individual rights. And in addition, there are also places that are not New York City and not even the United States. And so even if somehow or another you had a perfectly effective national vaccine mandate, which, to be clear, that is not possible. There is no way that's going to happen. But even if somehow or another Joe Biden could just wave his magic president wand and convince everyone to tomorrow go out and get their second shot and then 6 months later get their booster shot and everyone was vaxxed and boostered, you would still have other countries where we have no sphere of influence at all, where vaccine hesitancy is high, or where vaccines are still not available in the same way they are available in the United States. And so there's just going to be limited effectiveness to this. And so even if we're just arguing on practical grounds, not on like libertarian principle grounds, to me, this doesn't seem like it's worth it. And instead, what we're doing is we are saying, look, this is a thing that you have to do, and we're going to require you under penalty of law to do it. And what that does is it makes people who are hesitant and likely to resist, it makes them dig in. It is the opposite of persuasion. It is a kind of anti-persuasion. And I think that is the wrong way to be going about this. I do think people should get vaccinated. Go out and do it. Get a booster. You can now. It's free and easy.
I will also just note very quickly, like, the timeline is too short. Like, I am very keen on vaccines, as y'all know. I want to stab my children with needles. And my kids will be getting their second shot next Monday. And I, you know, sought out the vaccine. I like refreshed the CVS website a bunch of times to get those appointments. The idea that somehow in New York City, these millions of workers and children, upon hearing de Blasio's announcement, will be able to obtain a vaccine before this December 27th deadline strikes me as a bit of a stretch. And again, all of this rests on the bizarre phenomenon that they just know they're not really going to enforce it right away. And so there will be a bunch of wiggle room in those deadlines. But that sucks. Don't make laws that people can't follow.
Nick, at this point, where does de Blasio rank on your list of crap New York mayors?
Oh, that's a really fascinating topic, Matt. But, you know, the hats go off to Abe Beam, I think, who was a one-termer in the 70s and really he seemed to have been dropped in from the Soviet, from the Kremlin. He was a small gray man who, you know, just was awful. But de Blasio, you know, de Blasio won re-election, so you got to give him that.
Every 2-termer percentage points.
Yeah, every 2-termer, no matter what, is a winner on some level, and almost always, and this is it, I think every level of office holding, everybody who wins re-election is twice to four times as disappointing as they were in their first term, because they have no excuse, but they get worse and worse.
We're going to get to a double diplodocus of listener email here, and also an exciting
Zaphod Breibelbrox.
And also an exciting insert photo from the video webathon here. But first, as listeners of the Roundtable know all too well, the thing that we call health insurance does not, in fact, always pay for the full amount of medical bills during an emergency, especially for transportation. Even with so-called comprehensive coverage, you can still get hit with super high deductibles and copays. That is where the AirMed Care Network steps in. When you join AirMed Care as a member, if an emergency arises requiring transportation by air, you will not see a bill when flown by an AMCN provider. And you can have that peace of mind for your entire household beginning at the low, low price of just $85 a year. AMCN provides transport for more than 100,000 patients per year. As a listener to this very show, you can get, along with your new membership, a $50 Visa or Amazon gift card for Christmas. This is the kind of coverage that no family should be without. Simply visit airmedcarenetwork.com/reason and use the offer code REASON. Do it today. You'll be glad you did. All right, Catherine, you have an announcement. Breaking news.
Breaking news.
Someone make a typewriter sound. Breaking news. What's going on with the webathon, Catherine?
I think we should make like a Morse code sound. Like that's my preferred breaking news. Yeah, like that. So we learned right before we started taping this podcast that we have, for our webathon, which is going extremely well, just received news that we have an anonymous donor who has given us another $100,000 match.
$100,000.
Which is a lot of money. Like, I would enjoy using that money to fund Reason's excellent journalism up to and including this very podcast and perhaps more like it in the future, in order for us to take advantage of this match from this generous anonymous donor. We need you to give money and your money will be doubled. So we're kind of coming into the end of the webathon. Thank you for those of you who consume lots of Reason content. I know you have heard these pitches on many, many platforms at this point. We are almost done. But in order to get the most squeeze from our juice or whatever Matt would say at this point.
From our lemons.
Let's get this match met.
Speaking of Robert Plant, yes. So the webathon ends, I believe, midnight December 7th.
How was that related to Robert Plant? How was the lemon squeeze?
The lemon song.
They just say stuff sometimes to see if we're paying attention, and the answer is no.
Led Zeppelin 2, the lemon song. Come on, snap out of it.
I own that on vinyl. I don't know the song titles.
Anyways, so we plowed through a whole bunch of your emails that were awesome. During our bonus video episode, and if you haven't looked at that, please do. It's pretty funny. Keep sending your emails, which we read every week, to roundtable@reason.com, in part because so many of you in the little comments thing window mentioned the Roundtable and also Busted Balls, which is pretty funny. We're going to read two emails here, and it'll hopefully be kind of brief about them. But yes, thank you for all the really positive feedback. It's kind of blew me away. I have we have a post up this morning that just goes through a bunch of the different comments that are again very, very funny. Okay, this one comes from Jeff. Hi, just threw in my yearly donation. Was wondering if you folks have any plans to do any live tapings or special events with the Roundtable crew. Although I've never gone, live events always sound like a fun and rowdy time when some of the other podcasts I listen to host them. I was sad to miss the Fifth Crew in Miami, but the timing didn't work. That's a reference to the Fifth Column, where Nick Gillespie was a stunning, staggering guest in all senses of the word down in Miami. For better and for worse, after years of listening, I think my id has assimilated a little bit of each of you. And it would be great to get to watch you all do something live in person and meet some of the other weirdos who listen in, particularly since the dawning of our perpetual era of restrictions. Thanks for the weekly sanity check, Jeff. And he also gives us kudos for maintaining our little cultural what you listening and whatever recommendations thing as well. Catherine, we're going to do some live shows?
That sounds fun, but we do not, unfortunately, have any plans to do that at this time. Sometimes at Reason Weekend, we sometimes gather all of the roundtablers together and stick us on a stage. So one way to increase your chances of seeing us all together might be to donate to the webathon to the tune of I think it's $5,000, which gets you a ticket.
I do think it's important to see a band live to understand them. Yeah. And you can listen to a band as long as you want, right, on CD, on vinyl, on streaming, and you can like feel like you get them, and then you see them live, and suddenly their personality comes out. The last concert that I saw was Nine Inch Nails, right before the pandemic, and I've been listening to Nine Inch Nails at this point for 25 something years, right, and it's all like dark and goth and angsty, and no, here is Trent Reznor, 50 years old, and he starts the show by turning the house lights on entirely, like they're about to clean it up, like they're going to bring the janitors out and just pick up all the stuff off the floor. And then he walks out on stage with a baritone saxophone and is just like Kenny G-ing the shit out of this place. And then he goes on to play, Closer and Hurt and all that stuff, right? But he's just like, I'm 50 years old and I'm Trent Reznor. And sure, I'm wearing black jeans and a leather jacket. Not that there's anything wrong with that. But what I really want to do for you guys is play the saxophone. And you don't learn that until, you've heard him play some sax on some of the songs, but you don't learn that and how much he clearly cares about that and wants to put that first until you see him live.
So what we're saying is, Matt, we will do our best to put together a live show in which we all play the saxophone.
Yeah.
Matt,
that's the promise we're making here today.
We plan a live show in New York City. We drag these guys up from D.C. Yeah. And we let all double vaccinated private sector workers in for a reduced
risk. Saw none other than Nick Gillespie just yesterday perform at a comedy club in New York. It was another exciting installment of the Reason versus Jacobin debate series, moderated by Michael Moynihan from Vice. And there were a bunch of Reason stalwarts in the audience, and it was great. And everyone likes to see Nick perform live. So let's the next time in a cage with less clothes. That's all I ask for.
I gotta honor that promise. Thank you, Matt. That thing will be out. It's gonna be the last episode of a series that former Reasoner, current Fifth columnist, Michael Moynihan does for Vice. It's gonna be out sometime in January, from what I understand.
Yes, Catherine.
I do have a personal commitment not to go into comedy clubs because they stress me out, but I would make it.
Yeah, you don't have to be funny. Just sit there.
And it doesn't have to be a comedy club. It can be anywhere particular people congregate, as the sigil of Paul Mall Cigarettes talks about.
Second email here from David. Hello to the good doctor in residence, Dr. Gillespie, and his fellow hospital orderlies of freedom and justice. TM, he puts there. That's pretty good. One of my favorite features of this podcast and the magazine generally is the great pop culture criticism and engagement you all do. Sadly, I find that most libertarians are either completely aloof from pop culture, or they just reduce it all down to a wasteland of cancel culture and extreme political correctness. So my question is, why do you think that it's important to not just celebrate the principles of liberty, but to also actually engage with things people create with their freedoms? David Lowenthal asks you, Nick Gillespie. Tell us.
Well, I'll say two things to that point. One is that this is probably as important, if not more important, than what Reason does in all of its journalism when it talks about free minds and free markets leading to a fairer, richer, more fun, innovative world. You make the case for why those are good things, but then everything people are doing with that freedom, I think particularly in the cultural arena, those are demonstration projects. They show what is possible. You learn from that. I'm a big fan and have been of the John Stuart Mill concept of, running endless experiments, experiments in living, including imagined living that you get in things like art, literature, music, other forms of creative expression. So it's absolutely important. The other thing I think, that particularly the case about popular culture, and I would add one other horrible category to David Lowenthal's typology there, which are the libertarians who are obsessed with one small subset of popular culture, be it the Marvel Extended Universe, be it Star Trek or Star Wars
universe.
Or Dune or whatever.
What if you're
obsessed
with
tedious,
all of those?
It's tedious when people talk about this small bit of this incredible infinite space of imagination. But, you know, this is popular culture is where the conversation is. It's where more people live. It's where more people think about stuff. And so it's a great way to understand what's going on in the world, but also to understand how people think about freedom, how they think about liberty, how they think about making value in their life. And that is essential, certainly, to Reason's mission. And I think it ties in extremely tightly with libertarianism more broadly defined.
Catherine, do you want to weigh in on this very important topic?
Nick is right.
Suderman?
I'll just say that one of the things that attracted to me to Reason originally was the fact that Reason was a political magazine and interested in political ideas, but also really deeply engaged with pop culture. And then when I came here and worked with people, I found out that, in fact, the staff was even more deeply engaged with pop culture than I had known before. This is something that, you know, just sort of defines a prototypical Reason writer is a lot of outside interests that are not just politics and policy. And people take politics and policy very, very seriously here, but they are also like interested in fun and pleasurable and interesting and weird culture. And everybody has their sort of their area of expertise, but also there's a kind of wide rangingness to the interests here that I just find really delightful. And I learn stuff both from reading our coverage, but then also just from talking to my colleagues about what they are interested in all the time. And it's really wonderful.
All right, let's disprove. Yeah, go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, you know, it would be like not caring about culture in a world where you are free, you know, and this is something I wrote about over 20 years ago. You know, people are more free to produce and consume culture or self-expression, you know, more ways than ever. I mean, and that just keeps going. But it would be like saying, yeah, free speech is really important, but then never talking about the speech that actually gets made. It seems like you're not getting to the meat of the sandwich.
Let's see if we can. I'm just not gonna segue from a meat thing. Let's see if we can prove, Dave.
This episode brought to us by Arby's,
or
they've got the
Oscar Mayer
and the frankly. Speech. Yeah, Oscar Mayer.
Thigh stop.
There was a bunch of back and forth about Matt's claims about the name of the origin of
that was Nick's
the
claims
origin of the name
no
Arby's.
That was Nick's claims.
I thought you had a counterclaim, Matt. Didn't you?
I forget. I don't listen.
I don't know. It was all a blur. This is Arby's.
Well, yes. Let's
move
on.
Come on, guys. Where's the beef?
Yes,
Catherine. It's important to have 5 second pauses after Suter Manning's. Catherine, what have you consumed? Can we use as a demonstration project our own end of episode cultural consumption segment here to illustrate the cornucopia of human freedom? You start.
I mean, you're putting a lot of pressure on this like fairly rando one that I'm about to offer.
It's
here,
gonna
but,
be better than Nick's. That's all I gotta say. Go on.
I started listening to a podcast from Pineapple Street Studios called 70 over 70. And it's just what it sounds like. It's, you know, there's these like douchey 30 over 30 lists, Robbie Suave, and this, or 30 under 30 rather. This is 70 over 70. It's just a podcast talking to old people about what they know that other people don't know. And as some of you may or may not know, I'm a big Susan Lucci fan, and she was a recent guest, the star of Screen and Screen, All My Children's long, unawarded, Emmy-denied Erica Kane. But it's like a genuinely good, I am always trying to prepare to get old and also to better understand the olds in my life. And this has been really valuable. I haven't listened to all of them yet, but it's a pretty cool series. And if you too are an old or want to understand them better, 70 over 70.
What was Susan Lucci's wisdom?
Some of it was around the sort of thing I was joking about. You know, what does it mean when you are successful by some lights and not successful by others, and how do you evaluate yourself in that context? And that is something that we all can think about sometimes.
I will point to a years old, and it might have been it wasn't a webathon thing, but there is a post somewhere on the Reason site about likening Reason Magazine to Susan Lucci, because we had been in the Maggie Awards of the, you know, that we enter annually, and we kept being nominated for Best Magazine or something. But like Susan Lucci, we just couldn't win that daytime Emmy. But we finally
daytime,
did.
Anima. Yeah, that was the Maggie Awards. Poor 40 out. They're done. After 60-odd years of the Western Magazine Publishing Association, whatever it was called, is no more. So speaking of old people, Nick, what did you do last night?
Yep. Yes. Thank you. I went to see even older people. I went to see Reason trustee Ted Barnett, who is also the man who is auctioning off an NFT that is currently going for about $3,000. Hopefully it'll rally if Ether, the currency on the Ethereum network, actually gets its act together and goes up instead of down, down, down. But you can go to the Reason.com site and look for the NFT and go to OpenSea and bid on the Reason NFT in these last few hours of our Reason Webathon. But Ted Barnett had an extra ticket to see Genesis, the band that is fronted by Phil Collins, who is 70 years old and is falling apart. As we speak, it's a long world tour of a band that really dominated, helped define prog rock and dominated the late 70s and early 80s charts with a series of massive hits. Collins had his own solo career that was even in a certain way even bigger. But it was deeply moving, actually, to be in Madison Square Garden, which was sold out. They're playing again tonight. And seeing people, I'm 58, and I was on the younger edge of the audience. Most of the people there, I would hazard, were, you know, closer to Phil Collins' age. And it was amazing to see people who knew the lyrics to every song, which is a catalog that stretches back to the very early 70s through the current day, fist pumping and pounding. And Phil Collins cannot stand. He sits in a chair. He can't play drums. He had a bad back problem from drumming his whole life. And then he had a big injury in 2007. So he can't drum anymore. He sits in a chair and belts out these songs, sounding as good as he ever did. And they did things from the Peter Gabriel era, you know, from The Lamb Lies Down on Broadway and things like that. A lot of stuff from Duke to their more recent album, The Last Domino. And it's pretty freaking awesome. And so to go back to David Lowenthal, you know, rock music is a fantastic kind of articulation of freedom, of just Dionysian excess, sometimes mixed with Apollonian beauty. And it was on stage there last night at Madison Square Garden with Genesis, and they've still got a bunch of U.S. tour dates. So go see them if you want to see, you know, dinosaur rockers going out in
style. I just hope that in his wheelchair he played I Can't Dance.
Yeah, they did do that, of course. Of course they did. And the other thing, though, is that the Mike Rutherford and Tony Kaye, the other two members of the band who have been with it for the whole time, who were also on stage, are incredibly well preserved. And they present a different visage than, you know, Buster, Phil Collins. You know, they might be good fodder for the podcast that Catherine is listening to, because whatever they're doing, we should know about.
Phil Collins can be seen in the crowd in the movie Hard Day's Night. That's how old he is. I would also encourage people who are interested at all in Genesis to check out the great podcast Political Beats by Jeff Blair and Scott Bertram. Jeff Blair has almost convinced me to be interested in Genesis, which really takes a lot. I did appreciate them back in the day, but and I'm glad to hear all that they're out there performing, because at some point Phil Collins got sad. He like issued public apologies for being too popular, because he was a little bit oversaturated there in the mid to late 80s and playing Disney movies and all that kind of stuff.
He, in many ways, is a cautionary tale, but he seems to have kind of righted himself. And, you know, this will almost certainly be his last tour. But, it's really good. It's really interesting.
Although, don't we have Phil Collins to thank for the Tarzan soundtrack?
Which also beat South Park for an Academy Award. Yeah, the Tarzan soundtrack is...
and we also...
You know, he's got a lot of work to do.
I hope you say it's incredible. Like, he did not have to go that hard, and he did. My kids watched this movie recently, and I was like, what is happening right now? I think this is a testament to his greatness.
He did apologize. You know, he said that this band is standing on property that was taken from the Tarzan soundtrack at the beginning. So, you know, he's at least trying to make amends.
He's also partly responsible for the worst thing about 1980s music, which is the gated drum snare sound. So that's true.
But when he did it,
it was great.
It's pretty fantastic. I mean, so like you can't blame the master for the, you know, the student's bad essays or something like that. I'm trying to make.
It's like how Paul Greengrass innovated shaky cam and then everybody else tried it. And it was great when Paul Greengrass did it in the Bourne films and then terrible when everybody else did it.
I was just going to say that you can't blame Debussy for the soundtrack to Hallmark movies. So I guess we all have a way into this insight. And I'm glad we all got here together.
Suderman, what did you consume?
Thanks, Phil.
So as people who listen to this podcast know, I am a great consumer of cocktails, but also of cocktail books, not just recipe books, but books about cocktail history and theory. And I consider the greatest of the modern cocktail books to be the series that has now reached three books by the folks who run the now three bars called Death & Company, the original of which is in the East Village in New York City. And now there's an outpost in Denver and Los Angeles. The Death & Company bar in New York City, as I have said before, is my favorite bar in the world. And one of the greatest things about it is that in these books, they tell you how they do everything. So their very first book was just, here's how we do stuff at Death & Company, and then a crap ton of their recipes. Their second book was a theoretical book that basically said all cocktails can be divided into six base cocktails from which we innovate. And then their third book is focused on how to do this stuff at home. And this book just came out last month. It's called Death & Co. Welcome Home. And it's about half sort of guides to making cocktails at home. And it sort of helps you think through batching and party prep and things like that. And then since their previous book came out a few years ago, they have apparently developed more than 1,000 new cocktails, and about 600 recipes are printed in this book. So they're just showing you all the ways that they make these incredible drinks. And part of what's neat about this is that they treat their cocktails kind of like music, kind of like pop songs, right? Like each one of these things is just sort of meant to be consumed quickly. They turn over like new cocktails quite a bit, right? They're all based on a kind of structure and formula that they have been like working, you know, structures and formulas that are pretty basic that they have taken from history and then innovated from there. A bunch of their cocktails are actually named after punk songs. So like there's songs named like The Argument after Fugazi album, just because a bunch of these guys come from the world of punk rock and hardcore and are really into that. They've also taken to naming whiskey drinks after old westerns, which I think is great. So they even give you some insight into their naming scheme. Some of this stuff is going to be too advanced for kind of normie new cocktail makers. In particular, they go through things like how to build a round, which is like, hey, when somebody comes up and orders six really strange cocktails from you, here's how you make them all at once the fastest possible way. For most people, that's never going to be a thing they need to think about. But they do have a bunch of useful tips for how to think about throwing an event for your friends if you are, for example, the kind of person who throws cocktail parties. The other thing that's just great about cocktail culture is the way that they treat that cocktail makers and that the law treats cocktail recipes. So recipes cannot be copyrighted, and you can and anybody can share the recipe. You can copyright a collection of recipes. You can copyright very specific instructions, but very basic instructions you can't. So what they do is they just say, well, look, we are not going to try to make money by hiding all of this stuff from people. We're not going to try and make money by keeping our information secret. Instead, what we're going to do is we're just going to be better and more innovative and more interesting than our competitors. We're going to put all this stuff in really nicely packaged, fancy-looking books that feel great in your hand, but also contain a ton of information and teach you how to make great drinks. So like if you are interested in the practice of making super interesting, super excellent cocktails at the very highest level, the trio of Death & Company books is one of the best places to start. And Welcome Home is the book that is most squarely targeted at home bartenders trying to do this stuff in their kitchens or their home bar basements.
Cocktails and fashion are the best case against copyright, right?
Yep.
I would say that they are they're the best like models for why copyright maybe is a shouldn't exist in the way that
So
Matt, are you gonna whip up a picture of Gigi Allen's maybe?
don't think so. Not just yet. Jack Grisham from TSOL, the candidate for the recall election.
A lot of urine in that one, probably. Yes,
you're not wrong. I'm going to stay in character as well. I watched, this will surprise some people, a documentary about rock music. This was, in this case, a new thing called Tom Petty, Somewhere You Feel Free, The Making of Wildflowers. Wildflowers is his 1994 record. I think it's best-selling, close to it, certainly considered to be his most classic record. It's technically solo and not with the Heartbreakers, even though most of the Heartbreakers were around. He, during the kind of long, slow, rambling recording of this with Rick Rubin, jettisoned Howie Epstein, the drummer from the Heartbreakers, and got a new one. He also got a divorce. It's a big divorce, or began the process of getting a divorce. It's a big divorce record. Very, very great. I've always liked the follow-up to it. I've only recently started listening to Wildflowers. You would recognize, you know, You Don't Know How It Feels on it, and a couple of other things like that. You Wreck Me. The follow-up contains basically a bunch of songs from those sessions that they couldn't fit on the record. They recorded more than 30 songs. That one's called She's the One. It's one of my favorite records. Also very much kind of breakup-y, divorce-y records, which I always enjoy. Documentary was executive produced by his daughter. This is kind of an ongoing theme of a lot of rock documentaries these days, which is the family allows you to get access to, in this case, a bunch of footage that was filmed during those sessions that hadn't seen the light of day. And as a result, you don't kind of totally get into all presumably the heroin that Petty was doing at the time. Certainly was smoking a ton of weed and not having the greatest time in his life. But it's mostly on the flip side of that, like a lot of these other documentaries, including the John and Yoko documentary that Nick recommended previously about the making of Imagine, which is also sort of family sponsored. You get the flip side is that them just recording the process of making a record, which is actually in many ways, especially as some of us get older, more interesting than the usual gossip stuff surrounding it. So it's a very, if you're even half interested in Tom Petty or just in the making of music, it's very interesting. It's a combination of that footage plus some interviews post facto. And the only person who comes out not totally damaged is Rick Rubin. He seems to have kept his head over the years. The Heartbreakers, understandably, Tom Petty died a few years ago was, you know, he was a pretty interesting creative force, and they haven't recovered from it, and I get it, and it's kind of moving as well. It's interesting. There's a new, I saw it, watched it on YouTube. I assume it's on other streaming services, but also it is in compared to the Get Back documentary that just came out, like nothing is going to be as interesting. So it's a tough haul for music documentaries going forward, I think, considering what an amazing thing the Peter Jackson thing was.
You know, Rick Rubin hosted, I can't remember if I recommended it here or not, but I definitely watched it, a series of interviews that are on Hulu with Sir Paul McCartney.
Yeah.
That are just tremendous. I'm a Beatles completist and all of that kind of stuff, so I've heard everything. But Rubin's enthusiasm and exuberance for music, I mean, he is one of the great producers of the past 40 years. He gets a lot of really good stuff out of Paul McCartney that nobody else
does. Which is really, really difficult because McCartney's been saying the same damn things over and over again. And one of the things that was struck home listening to the Petty musicians talk about Rubin is that he doesn't know how to play music, which is pretty interesting and rare from a producer. He just has an ear and a feel. He's a super fan. And from what the little clips I've seen with him talking to Paul, he's just like super geeking out on, oh my God, you did this on Abbey Road. Let's listen to it and talk about it, and smiles. And that's all very thrilling and nice. All right. That's all the thrills and niceness that we have time for here on the Reason Roundtable podcast. Listen to all of our stuff at Reason.com podcasts, including the Tremendoid Reason interview with Nick Gillespie and the Soho Forum debate series with Gene Epstein. Thank you again for all your nice comments, especially, and your donations for the Reason Webathon. And we got just a few hours left and a matching grant of $100,000. Are you kidding me? Double the money if you can. Give till it hurts so good, etc. And we will see you next Monday. Goodbye.